please.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the Court. This is an ERISA case, Your Honor. In the time that I have, I thought that it would be useful to give you some of the flavor of our view of the case. I think fundamentally, we look at the district court's decision as being one which inverted the findings that are required on summary judgment. We read the opinion of the court to basically accept in large measure many of the factual contentions of the appellees in this case, of which there are several, one of whom the insurance company is no longer in the case. But as to the employer and its delegated agent, we think that the fundamental analysis of this case must begin from our view, at least, that the district court was required but did not assume all the facts in our favor. Many of the central facts are disputed, but when they are assumed in our favor, we think that it's absolutely clear that a finder of fact could clearly draw the inference that the employer, at least in this case, whether acting for itself or acting for the plan, surely did its best, one, not to maximize the likelihood of the coverage of the appellant in this case. And then after they came to issue, that is, after Mr. Kamler was terminated, returned to California, and had his heart attack, and his lawyer in California made a demand for the health insurance payment, at least the employer in this case did absolutely everything it could not to help him to perfect whatever claim it was that he had. There is no question in this case. It is an uncontested, agreed fact that the employee, Mr. Kamler, did not submit the form that was required to perfect his insurance. We believe that at least under the Epright case in the Third Circuit, that there is a legitimate question presented, somewhat close to what happened in Bowerman, which we cite in our brief in several places, raising the question of whether or not that a precondition can be excused under the law of ERISA. That's the fundamental question in the case. Now, if you look at what happened here, the employer, Mr. Kamler was hired in the middle of March. The employer waited for 2 weeks until the last day of March to do anything related to perfecting coverage. That delay in and out of itself was prejudicial to Mr. Kamler, because had he been enrolled before the end of March, his coverage would have started on April 1st. There's absolutely no contest here, and I'm sure that counsel for appellee will concede that that two-week delay in and of itself would have prevented, indeed, had the form been submitted properly, would have prevented Mr. Kamler from perfecting coverage on the first day he was entitled to, and that was the first day of the month following his employment.
Did Mr. Kamler ever ask any questions as to why this wasn't taken care of within that two-week time?
Your Honor, I don't think the record supports that he did. When he finally got the application, which he was in a place, a remote province in Brazil.
Was he ever sent an insurance card?
No, never.
Did he ever ask about that?
Your Honor, I don't think the record supports that he did. But what he did do, the first time the evidence supports that he got the application, he promptly examined it, and he looked at it. It was unsatisfactory to him. He looked at it, and first of all, it was incomplete, as we argue, I think, extensively in our brief. It was missing an essential notice about essentially investigative efforts that the insurance company reserved the right to make. That missing part of the form, we think in and of itself, is a justification for excusing the condition of submission of the form. But the evidence unquestionably, when viewed in his favor, I don't think there's anything that contradicts it, it unquestionably supports that as soon as he got the incomplete form, he looked it over, he read that authorization regarding the kind of investigation that the company wanted to make, and he questioned it. And his questions were justifiable. The evidence supports his testimony was, in essence, that I called Lamplota and I said, I want to know what these people want to look into. I want to know why are they so intrusive into my and my family's privacy concerns. And the evidence viewed in his favor demonstrates that without question, although there's a factual dispute about it, there's a different version, Lamplota has a different version, But viewing what Mr. Kamler said in the light most favorable to him, Mr. Lamplota told him, well, let me look into it and I will get back to you. That invokes a whole series of rules that this court, it's embedded in this court's jurisdiction, indeed nationally, throughout all the decisions of all the courts of appeal and district court, that when an employee makes an inquiry on a material matter related to coverage and in advance of coverage, the employer, whether as an agent for itself or whether as an agent for the plan, is under a fiduciary obligation under the circumstances to respond appropriately and as promptly as those circumstances require. And the circumstances in this case, because every month that passes delays your eligibility yet another 30 days, the circumstances in this case suggest under those rules of law that there's no question at all that the employer's failure to make an inquiry and report back to Mr. Kamler about those things that were causing him not to fill out the form was a breach of fiduciary duty. They did not do that. And that sort of refers back to the point that I'm trying to stress to the court, that the employer in this case did, either by omission or failure to act, or by active interference, did not do those things that one would necessarily seek to impose or expect from an employer to perfect the coverage of the employee.
You rely on that two-week period initially when you say if the documents have been sent, that was somehow, I don't know, derelict or negligent of the employer not to send it. Do you have any authority relating to the timing of sending documents like this or any case law?
Your Honor, we could find no authority that talked about that. The window is narrow. There's no question. But the terms of this policy, of this insurance policy, and the terms of the employer guide, it seems to me is a sufficient factual grounding for this court to evaluate what's the extent of the duty. The employer's guide that was given to the employer, and of course not to Mr. Campbell or any other employee, says that the best time to enroll an employee is on or near very close to the date of employment. And that's something that was not done in this case, and it would have been a very simple matter when they're faxing back and forth, Mr. Kamler in California.
Well, what is very near to the date of employment in a 52-week year?
Well, in this case.
No, I know, but you're using the language very near.
Well, the employer guide says the best time to do it is at the time of the
You said at or very near. Is what you just told me.
Well,
I don't know.
At or very near in this case is clearly not the 6 weeks that it took Mr. Lamplota to get the form actually into the appellant's hand. At or very near has to be decided in reference to when can coverage be affected the most early. And so at or very near, if we need a general rule, in this case it seems to me, Your Honor, would be at such a time that would be sufficient to enroll the employee at the first possible date. And in this case, that would have been sufficiently in advance of the end of March for the forms to get back and forth. After all, there are mechanical issues, ministerial issues of getting a form filled.
Apparently the form was attempted to be sent in March, isn't that right?
Well, I guess the answer to that, Your Honor, is there is some evidence to suggest that, yes. But if we view the evidence in favor of the appellant, the evidence clearly shows that he did not get it until about May 6th. The testimony has to be viewed in his favor in that regard, and it is corroborated. It's not just his testimony. There is some evidence from Mr. Lamplota. There is a fax confirmation sheet and a memorandum that's dated March 31st, and you combine those things together, and there's some evidence to suggest one thing, and that is that the documents were faxed to Brazil on March 31st. There's some evidence to suggest that. Mr. Kamler's testimony, which is corroborated by the testimony of the fellow at the Brazilian office in the headquarters in the capital of Brazil, his testimony is that I never got this in hand until May 6th, and as soon as I got it, I looked at it. It said coverage is to start on May 1st. I said, thank goodness, nothing happened in April. because my coverage has started. I understood, he testified, he understood from that that his coverage had started, because that's in essence what this fact said, this March 31st memorandum. He said, I read over the application, I essentially immediately got on the phone and I called back to Chicago to inquire about these issues related to privacy.
Can you speak to his temporary employee status, one of the arguments your opponent makes, that because he was in this probationary period that somehow his ERISA benefits didn't vest?
Well, their argument is a little bit different, I think, Your Honor, as I understand it. Their argument is that their insurance coverage plan was such that the policy of the company, indeed under the plan, was that during the first 90 days of employment, it was a probationary period, and because of that, the employer would not pay the premiums. After that, they say, it was discretionary with the company's president, as I understand it. Our view about that is that is, first of all, it's contested, it's contradicted as a matter of fact. They say that policy was uniform, at least in our reply brief. We cite the courts of the record that demonstrates that, in fact, there were people who were treated completely contrary to this supposed uniform policy, people whose premiums were paid right from the beginning, including that 90-day period. But secondly, and more fundamentally, it seems to me that the whole idea that they would have this essentially unwritten policy that was different than the constituting documents of the plan is itself an impermissible amendment of ERISA. That sort of comes back and bites them, because this, I am not aware of any place in the record, other than a couple of affidavits, that shows a document that followed the amendment procedures of the plan that gives this 90-day window where the employee is supposed to pay it. The testimony about it, the evidence about it, is essentially verbal from the witness, coming in part from some affidavits that they submit in support of summary judgment. So our view about
You're
it is...
You're into your rebuttal time, you and
me. Yes, I know. Our view about it is, Your Honor, that as a matter of fact, the evidence substantially contradicts the existence of that policy, and even if it did exist, it was invalid because it violated the terms of the plan. I'll reserve my balance.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. Martha Pagliari on behalf of all of the appellants in this case. With respect to the issues first raised by Mr. Kekas, I'd just like to address a couple of factual allegations. First of all, the district court was absolutely correct in their analysis of the facts in this case. What the district court reviewed was the policy, the plan language itself. The plan required that an application be made in writing to the insurance company on a form acceptable to the insurance company. In this case, there's absolutely no dispute that that was not done. The enrollment form itself states to be completed by the employee. It also has a provision to waive coverage or elect coverage. And for that reason, the form itself is not ministerial, as the plaintiff has argued in their opening and reply brief. The form was the necessary first step in order to trigger the coverage. In this case, there's no indication that Mr. Kamler ever elected coverage. He has one statement where he says, I believe that when he interviewed with Mr. Lamplota, his statement that I won't begin working until I'm insured guaranteed him insurance. That statement was belied by the documents in this case. He received, at least by May 6th, it's undisputed, that he received a memo from George Lamplota dated March 30th, 1998, which read, please fill out the attached enrollment form and fax back as soon as possible. The coverage is to start by May 1st. That document was a contradiction of his belief that coverage had started automatically the day he started his employment. At that point, his duty of self-protection under Andre kicked in, and he should have called his insurer, called his employer, or done something to ensure or to find out what was going on with his coverage. The other memo that was attached to that also said, review the attached documents, please fax back to the San Paolo office. Those documents read together indicate that they were following the dictates of the plan, which were to submit a completed and signed enrollment form, which indicated whether or not the employee wanted coverage. In this case, that those facts are absolutely...
Well, you know, they're making the argument, at least here today, that he read the materials that were sent to him and he had a question about privacy. So he called up Lampota and asked him a question, and Lampota never got back to him, which may or may not be a sufficient excuse for not filing the application. But what's your response to that?
With respect to that allegation of the plaintiff, our response is that request was immaterial. Under the terms of the policy, he had to submit the enrollment form. His concerns about the privacy were questions about what did the insurance company want. The insurance company's name was clearly delineated at the top of the form as well. His questions about privacy didn't go to whether or not he needed to fill out the enrollment form or whether or not he was requesting insurance. They were questions about...
Well, I assume if you filled it out, that would be a consent to whatever they wanted to... questions they wanted to ask, wouldn't it?
Right. If he filled out the enrollment form...
Apparently he didn't want to consent to that at the time.
Right, but that was his choice. If he decided not to consent to the disclosure of his information, which is conditioned to the coverage, that was a decision that only he could make.
But
that
the fact of the matter is the company didn't get back to him. I mean, that was counsel's point. He had some questions. He wanted it clarified. He asked for clarification. He didn't get any.
And the ERISA law in that matter is that the employee at this point in the enrollment process has a duty of self-protection. The employer is not acting as his agent or his fiduciary. At that point, it was the plaintiff's obligation, Mr. Kamler's obligation, to find out what that meant, and if Mr. Lampota didn't get back to him, to follow up. There is no evidence in this case that
what Mr. What site do you have to uphold that position?
That's Andre versus Salem.
That the employee has to get back to him once he has called the employer and the employer does not answer.
Well, that would be the duty of self-protection, I believe, under Andre. And Andre, the facts of that case were much more onerous to the employer. In that case, I believe Mr. Andre had filled out a request form indicating that he did want coverage. He said that he, after he did that, he was not given an enrollment form and that the documents that the company supplied said insurance is automatic. In this case, absolutely none of that took place. There was no document that guaranteed coverage. Plaintiff argues that the employment manual that says the company...
Well, I know, but is the problem of the lack of employment coverage on the employer for not answering his questions before, as Judge Cuddy asked you, if he had filled it out, then he would have agreed to to everything in that form.
Well, that's right. I think, as a practical matter, the application for insurance requires some disclosure of what would be sensitive or medical information.
There's no doubt.
By definition. If he refused to disclose that information, I don't think that he would be able
but
to get coverage.
But does he refuse by calling in to ask a question concerning it, and he doesn't get an answer?
Well, the answer to that question, I think, is that only Mr. Kamler could have made that decision. If he didn't get an answer, and that was material to his decision, then he had the duty or the obligation to find out what that meant. PAL, the employer, did not foreclose him from doing that. They didn't prevent him from contacting the insurer.
They just didn't send him the information.
Right, but there's no, or at least that's the allegation that
right.
of all the laws up to sex. But there's no indication that was a material part of his decision not to fill out the application. In his testimony, he said he believed...
Well, what's the presumption at this time on the motion?
Well, I think that
the trial court...
The trial court looked at it as whether or not that issue was material, and what they determined was that there was no evidence that was material to him in his decision.
And what was the basis for that finding?
On the trial court level?
Yes.
That he hadn't testified to that based on his testimony, essentially his testimony as a whole, he indicated that he didn't fill out the application because, first of all, he thought he was already insured, he had automatic coverage. He did essentially nothing to ensure that he had coverage. That belief was not supported by any evidence in the record. He didn't get an insurance card. He didn't get any indicia of insurance. And
well, he could have signed the application and sent it back, but instead of that, he asked a question, which I gather in his mind, at least, was quite material to the transaction. And it seems to me that that does interject an element here that has to be explained.
Well, I think the issue is whether or not that was material to the outcome of the case. In this case, only Mr. Kamler can make that decision. If he chose, he could choose not to apply for the insurance or not to enroll in the insurance plan because he didn't want to disclose that information. He could choose to elect coverage and then
Suppose he wanted to be reassured that the whatever the requirements were in the application didn't really mean anything, and that, therefore he could sign it and he'd be in the clear. But he never got a response.
At this point in the enrollment process, that's a risk that Mr. Kamler takes, not a risk that the employer takes under Andre and Pohl. He has the duty of ascertaining what the information is required. He has the duty of making sure that if he wants coverage, that the enrollment form is completed. And in fact, under the plan, in this case, and the enrollment form itself, only he can sign and fill out that.
What do you have to say? Why should the employer gain or benefit from his refusal to follow up the employee's inquiry?
I don't think that the employer refused to follow up. I think
he just didn't do it. How would you classify that?
Well, the employer in this case didn't answer a question that he had pertaining to the application or the enrollment form. I think under the Andre and Pohl case, the issue is whether or not...
I think you're expanding that envelope pretty far, from a size 11 to about a 14.
But the issue at this point, I think, or what the holdings of those cases show, is that in this instance, at that point, the employee, Mr. Kamler, has a duty of self-protection. If there's a risk of that information not coming in,
what would you believe if the employer told you that your coverage was going to begin on May 1st? Had you received notice that it was going to begin on May 6th? You had none.
Well, the notice...
I mean, we put all of those things together, and at the point that this case is, this motion before trial, you tell us how we should answer this.
With respect to the coverage to start by May 1st, in the context of those documents, that is clearly a conditionary statement. It is not a guarantee of coverage. The statement says...
What would you assume it to be? If you were the employer, employee,
I would, first of all, I would be concerned...
Would you put the employer under oath or what?
Well, in this case, Mr. Kamler received that and did absolutely nothing. He never conveyed to his employer or the insurer that he even wanted insurance, that he was electing coverage. At the point where he received that memo, that was contradicted.
Well, he said originally he wouldn't go to Brazil unless he was covered.
That's right. And when he received that memo in May, that contradicted that belief. At that point, he was put on notice that certainly his belief that coverage started immediately was an error. And it's on March 30th, it says the coverage is to start by May 1st. Not the coverage will start, not the coverage has started. And when he receives the next memo, both of those memos are imploring him, fill out the form, please fill out the form, which is something that only he can do, and which is a condition precedent to the insurance becoming applicable. And with respect to the payment of premium, which the plaintiff raises quite a bit, the issue with that is it doesn't become a duty until the application is completed and submitted by the employee. In this case, there's absolutely no question that wasn't done. The fact that he asked a question about, had one question about the employee enrollment form does not mitigate against him still having to fill out that form in order to obtain the insurance. The contract documents are absolutely unambiguous on that point. They require that a completed signed enrollment form must be submitted before coverage attaches. That wasn't done here in this case, and that has ramifications throughout under ERISA. First, he's not a participant because he hasn't elected coverage. He doesn't have any claim to vested benefits because he hasn't, or a colorable claim to vested benefits because he has not signed and submitted the enrollment form. With respect to the promissory estoppel argument, the plaintiffs have not established the elements. Specifically, they haven't established a material misrepresentation in writing. The documents, as the district court correctly pointed out, don't indicate that coverage is automatic. Instead, they indicate that he must fill out those employee enrollment forms and get them back to them. With respect to the prevention of a precedent or an occurrence precedent to the coverage, these documents don't do that at all. In fact, they are the opposite. They say you must fill out the form and submit it to us or to the insurance company. And that is exactly what the contract documents and the plan documents provide, unlike Upright, Swoyer, or Swayback, and Bowerman. In those cases, in Bowerman and Swayback, the persons involved were already participants. In Upright, the court excused the enrollment form because, first of all, it was ministerial in that case because he was to go to Florida or to Pennsylvania to fill out the enrollment forms after the coverage was to begin. Unlike in this case, which is more analogous to the Freeman Local Andre cases, the form, or the enrollment form, was a condition precedent to coverage because it asked him to waive or elect coverage. And
let me ask you this, just because I want to get back to the findings of the district court and also materiality. In the deposition of Kamler, does he talk about the fact that he did not fill out the forms because of these privacy concerns, but the district court just doesn't buy that? I mean, does he testify to that at all in his deposition?
No.
The reason that he didn't fill out the form is because he needed to have this information?
No. He's silent on that. His reasons for not filling out the form, he never really explains that. He admits he got the form. He admits he didn't do it. He admits that he understood that if you're employed by an employer, that doesn't automatically bring coverage. But for some reason, he never got around to filling out the form.
So that was not part of what the district court considered for purposes of summary judgment.
No.
Because he never testified to that.
Right. And I believe they found that argument was immaterial since he didn't testify that he relied on or needed that information in order to decide to become
insured. So that was the basis of the district court's ruling that it wasn't material.
That's right.
Because there was nothing in the record. I mean, there were other things that they argued made
right.
it material. But I mean, in terms of words from the plaintiff's
exactly.
mouth, did
exactly.
not come out.
Exactly. He had questions about it. And with respect to the payment of the premiums, likewise, they said that wasn't material because whatever the plan said, Mr. Kamler repeatedly stated that he was not aware of that. That 90-day temporary period where the employee paid the premium. And so that way they found that was also immaterial. My time is up. I will wrap it up in one sentence.
Do you need half a minute?
Sure.
Go ahead, because we have asked you a lot of questions.
Thank
go ahead.
You. We are simply asking the court to affirm the district court in this case. The rulings were factually, the facts they relied on are uncontested, that Mr. Kamler received the enrollment form, he received the documents instructing him to fill out the enrollment forms, and he chose not to do that. The plan documents are absolutely not ambiguous at all with respect to the requirement that an enrollment form is necessary for coverage under this plan. And the finding that he never completed the enrollment form has ramifications in that he did not become a participant. The contract is clear on its face, so he's not entitled to an estoppel to change those terms. In the enrollment process, Mr. Kamler was under a duty of self-protection, and he was not protected by the fiduciary obligations under ERISA because the employer did not stand in the position of a fiduciary with respect to the enrollment process. And I did not address the final two counts, which is the statutory fees. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
You want to rely
sure.
on your brief for that?
Certainly. That would be great.
Thank you.
Thank
Kamler.
You.
All right. 3 minutes? All right. You have 3 minutes, sir.
Your Honor, on the last question, I've been puzzled throughout this case and some of the representations that have been made in the defense. The district court was presented and sort of slid by the question of why it is Mr. Kamler did not sign the form. There is a slight reference to it in the opinion of the court. Basically, the court concluded that characterized that he called, had questions about the form, but the questions had nothing to do about whether or not he filled out the form. Both the district court and counsel, respectfully, completely ignored a fundamental argument that we made that is based on this testimony of appellant, which appears at our appendix, our main appendix at page 27, from his deposition, when he says he called Lamplota, what was the substance of the conversation? Answer, that I didn't want to sign this thing because of what they were asking on here, in the effect of they could go and I was releasing any information from all of my family for credit reports, and there were some other things in here that I just said that I felt was going beyond the insurance company's right of privacy for myself, and I wanted to know why it was here. And I think, Your Honor, that is dealt with on pages 12 and 13 of our brief. There is no question in this case, especially when he's given the benefit of the doubt, there's no question that he did not complete this form and he called Lamplota because he was concerned about his privacy rights, and there's no question in this case that it was in the record. Now, Your Honor, Judge Coffey asked me in my argument earlier about what is the question of timing, what's the earliest, what's the best time. And I refer, Your Honor, to page 188 of our appendix, which includes a portion of the employer guide, which contains the following statement. I want to be precise that the court understands what the record shows. And it says, quote, the best time to enroll a new employee and their dependent is when he or she is hired. It is important to get the completed enrollment form into StarMark as soon as possible in order to avoid many months of back billing on premiums, and then there's another reference. So those are two very, very important, critical factual issues that I think...
He was hired over the long-distance phone, and he was immediately in transit to Brazil, so isn't there a practical problem trying to accommodate that principle that he should be enrolled immediately?
They had enough time to execute a written agreement for employment, Your Honor. They went back and forth, and they did, in fact, fax documents back and forth. I think the record shows that Mr. Cameron had a fax in his home. But there's no question that they were faxing documents back and forth. And, you know, it would have been a real good time for the employer to fax this thing, too. By the way, we got these things that have to be done.
As soon as possible is a pretty broad time, too. Possible. That's a pretty broad term.
Well, Your Honor, I concede that's right. It's broad, and it has to be looked at in the context of a particular case.
But this doesn't support what you're trying to say as well.
I would suggest, Your Honor, it does, because they could have exchanged the... One of the problems...
Not what they could have done. I didn't say what they could have done.
Well, it was possible.
Oh, yeah, it was possible.
To say it this way, to use the terms Your Honor suggests. It was possible.
No, that's the term that you gave me out of the book.
I think it's when... He is hired is what...
Or as soon as possible.
Let me read it again. The best time to enroll a new employee and their dependents is when he or she is hired.
Now,
it is important to get the completed enrollment form into StarMark as soon as possible in order to avoid many months. The difference here is this case does not involve the employer's failure to get a completed form back to the insurance company. This case involves the failure of the employer to get the form to the employee to fill out, and then after the long delay, passing many important milestones, when Mr. Kamler makes a material inquiry about something of essential importance regarding this form, if privacy is not important, why is it on the form? Why does he have to release it? It's material, almost as a matter of law. I suggest that the company failed in its obligation to respond, and we have a section of our brief that talks about the scope of the duty of the employer to respond to material questions of an employee.
If I could just ask one other question, how do you distinguish Andre? Because she relied heavily on Andre, and you haven't really spoken to that and that duty of self-protection.
Your Honor, our brief talks, I think, at some length with Andre. Andre is a case that takes out of context some language in one of Judge Posner's opinion about the existence of a fiduciary duty. And we deal with the Andre question at a portion of our brief. I think it's page 32. The headline is, there is no rule of self-protection in ERISA jurisprudence. We think, Your Honor, that there's another case of this court that's cited at that section of our brief that basically eliminates the right of self-protection here. What there obviously is a requirement of an employee to fill out a form when he gets it. There's no question that there's some things that an employee necessarily has to do. None of those minimal acts are implicated in this case because he did what he needed to do to perfect his right of self-protection, as we argue, I think, in our reply brief as well. We also think that there is no such thing as the right of self-protection in ERISA law. We think it's been eliminated by the court's decisions that are cited in our brief, and we think that it's a very, very dangerous thing, especially in the facts of this case, to impose such a right.
Thank you, counsel. We will proceed to case number 2, please.